Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Rick Ackerman, editor of Rick's Picks on rickackerman.com, talks about the mass psychology that could affect trading trends. He also looks at deflating home prices in the U.S. and how it could make the 2008 real estate collapse look like child's play. He says no one wants to talk about the crisis brewing with vacant commercial real estate and how it could even bring ruin to public transit systems. Editor and publisher of the VR Newsletters, Mark Leibovit, joins us from Arizona to talk about technical analysis and how charts rule if you're going to be a great trader. Mark also weighs in on how cycles can affect the markets, and those cycles could range from financial events to solar activity. He also has an outlook for Bitcoin. We'll talk to Rick Ackerman right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
Our guest is Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thanks very much for having me on, Jim. It's always a pleasure and a privilege to connect with your audience.
Let's talk about mass psychology in the markets. The Dow, the S&P 500, and the NASDAQ are getting close to their previous highs. We heard a prediction of 65,000 for the Dow. Does mass psychology play a role in markets moving higher and higher?
You know, there's always going to be some bonehead out there talking about Dow 65,000, and as soon as that prediction gets a little bit of airplay, someone will be out there with 100,000. And I have to say that looking out over the very long haul, I've got nothing to suggest that it's impossible. You know, these numbers sound so far-fetched, but when I was looking for a major top with the Dow around 2,500, you know, Dow 40,000, Dow 50,000 would have looked pretty far-fetched too.
When bad news hits markets, does mass psychology cause additional downward pressure?
Well, I've always felt that there is no such thing as bad news or good news as far as how it's perceived. The market tells us how to look at it. So, and you know that it's true that sometimes a company will announce horrendous earnings and the stock will go up anyway. And that really has to do with the bad news being discounted. But the bozos who invent the news will always find a way to say, they'll tell us exactly why the bad earnings numbers are actually good. But it's really the markets that color our perception of the news. So however bad the news, if the stock market is going up on that same day, you're going to hear interpretations of the news that shade it in a very bullish way.
Are gold bugs a form of mass psychology, and how do they affect gold?
I think there's sort of a mass depression right now. I mean, even all gold investors know we're in a gold bull market, but it's not one that's given to making everybody feel a bullion, really. It's a bitch, you know. The gold just kind of gets you psyched up, and then it kind of dies. So and it dies in a way you're thinking, well, maybe I should throw in the towel. And just when you're ready to do that, or the day after you've done it, the market pops again and gold for no reason just blasts off. But I think if you take a step back, you can see that the big buyers in this world, every sovereign entity on this planet is buying gold. So whenever you hear a story when gold's down for a couple weeks and getting hit, and people say, well, I think we've seen the top, that's absurd, because the appetite for accumulating bullion by every sovereign entity in the world, we're talking about everything from the Bank of India to some local Afghani bank, they're all buying gold. So I wouldn't worry too much. The demand is there, and sometimes the big boys just kind of pull their bids and let it let it fall so they can start accumulating again at lower prices.
Silver bugs and mass psychology, your thoughts?
Well, so silver's been kind of interesting lately. You know, the most of silver's fan club, they've gotten kind of depressed because the gold-silver ratio went actually over 100 to 1. That's historically a very rare event, and it reflects the fact that silver relative to gold is egregiously undervalued. But then, lo and behold, all it takes to bring things, or at least to start a process where that ratio comes back into line, is just a number of days when silver is up 1.5 or 2% and gold much less so. So just a few significant rally days in silver with gold acting relatively placid are enough to begin to correct that ratio so that it comes down to, well, who knows what would be reasonable at this point, but you know that silver in a bullion bull market, silver is going to be a late, it's finally, when it gets to the final turn, that's when it really pours it on, and we're nowhere near that yet. So silver's got a very bright future ahead, and of course, if you're looking at companies with silver in the ground, proven reserves, you've got still many, many bargains in the mining sector.
Do you think Bitcoin attracts mass psychology or occult psychology?
Bitcoin is just every mania has its center, and Bitcoin, I guess, could be the currency center of this mania. The idea that it could be worth anything is ridiculous on its face. You know, Bitcoin has zero value. Or as we've discussed before, I'll allow that Bitcoin might be worth $2 or $3 per, but certainly not you know, $50,000 or $100,000. So Bitcoin is just sort of the nuttiness of this age, and you've always got ostensibly respectable people saying that Bitcoin is that it's a good thing, and they'll tell you why it's worth something. But nobody in the world can make a good argument that Bitcoin is worth anything. It essentially appeared out of nowhere, and it's not money. We know that. It doesn't function as money. It's a purely speculative medium. Nobody really uses it for transactions, and there's no actual reason why Bitcoin should have any value at all, other than its ability to record a transaction securely with blockchain technology. That's worth something. It's just an accounting system, but as I said, that's only worth $2 or $3 per Bitcoin, not $100,000 per.
Do interest rate moves cause mass psychology to be bullish or bearish on a number of things?
That's, I think, the opposite of psychology. Psychology, in the context of the markets, implies that people they fluctuate from one extreme to the other, but interest rates tend to move pretty slowly, and we don't feel so much the psychology of it as the reality of it. So it isn't a psychological thing. When mortgage rates get up close to 7%, as they are right now, it's not any kind of psychology that prevents people from buying houses. It's strictly the numbers. There is some small psychological component to that, and that is that if everybody thought that home prices were going to continue to climb steeply, then a 7% mortgage would present less of a problem. You know, we've had times when housing boomed with high, even higher interest rates than we have now. But of course, that was before we all got conditioned to borrowing down around 4% or even less to buy a house. So I guess people in their heads are sort of measuring the possibility, the potential for appreciation in residential real estate when they consider taking a mortgage loan. But I think right now the perception is that home prices are a little bit rich to jump in with the 7% mortgage and hope that further real estate appreciation will bail you out.
The housing market and mass psychology. How does mass psychology affect the housing market?
Well, it does to the extent when people own, if you own a home and let's say you have no mortgage on it and you bought it for 270 and now it's worth 810, you're feeling a little bit richer. You do things you might not ordinarily do. You might go out and buy a sailboat or take an expensive cruise tour or something like that. So that's pretty much true across the length and breadth of America. All the baby boomers, I say all, but I mean just a great preponderance of them, are in homes that cost them a pittance, but which are now worth quite a bit more. And the oddity, it's really kind of amusing, but obviously they have not, nobody's done the math really, meaning these homes may be worth $800,000 or $1.5 million or $3.2 million, but who will be the buyers for those homes? So when the baby boomers include real estate valuations in their nest egg, they're not really accounting for the fact that there are no buyers for all those homes. The millennials and Gen Xers, Gen Y, Gen Z, I don't know what we're up to. I guess Gen Z, the ones who don't even, they're the ones who supposedly settle bar tabs with each drink. They're not big spenders, and they're certainly not spenders in the category of $1.5 million baby boomer McMansion. So there's a deception there in this idea that we're all rich because the homes in this country have increased so much in value.
Markets in times of war, is mass psychology causing money to move into the reserve currency, the U.S. dollar?
We're kind of in a time of war, really. It became so obvious that Europe actually wanted to start a war with Russia, and they were hoping to provoke the U.S. to do that for them, but of course, Trump just wasn't buying it. So we're kind of on 1913, 1914-ish footing, where we could have all kinds of wars, and the markets don't seem to have noticed, or they haven't flinched, really. And in the case of Europe, the idea of war it's equates directly to stimulus. You know, if you're fighting a war, then your economy is on a wartime footing, and Europe could certainly use a little of that because its economy otherwise is dead.
Is a general rule of thumb to observe mass psychology and do the opposite of the herd?
No, you really can't. You know, when we talk about contrarianism, just do what everybody else is not doing and you'll make money, that's not the kind of contrarianism that really makes money. It's more the Rothschild style, where you buy them when there's blood running in the streets. So to equate that to the current markets, we could say that it's good to do what everybody else is not doing, but it has to happen in your gut. You know, to act in a contrary way, it's not an intellectual process that you arrive at. It's more like an emotional process where you're thinking you'd have to be out of your bloody mind to buy stocks at this time, and then on that basis you go in and you buy stocks anyway. So the whole contrarian instinct, in order for it to work best, it has to go against your gut. You have to feel a churning in your stomach before you act against the crowd.
On the flip side, markets can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. Would it be fair to say mass psychology can be used as an overview for markets, but not an indicator?
Yeah, tell me about it. You know, I was saying earlier about Peter Elides and a trend line that goes back to the year 1790. And, you know, if you'd been bucking that trend, the long-term trend for markets to go higher over time, they just do, then that was a losing game. But this time around, just to speak of this particular bull market, we're into year 16 plus a few months, and that's, we don't have any bull markets of that duration. It's really gone on for so long, and in so many ways, it's flouted what seemed to be a much darker reality. The market has gone up in the absence of earnings. It's gone up in the face of really bad news. It doesn't really matter what happens. The market has simply gone up. And yes, this has challenged rationality itself and the strategies of investors who think that they're doing the rational thing when they buy this stock or that.
What's your comment or thoughts on the tariff wars that are going on right now? Because we never know what they're going to be day to day.
We don't even know if they're a war anymore. You know, the countries that we would ostensibly be making war on, they've come up with their own interesting ways to parry Trump's threats. And I try to follow it pretty closely, but I got no idea where we stand. You know, we've got so many, there's so many pauses right now in the more stringent tariff measures and this and that. But, and at times I've been convinced that a little bit of tariff couldn't hurt too much, but now I'm not so sure really. I mean, everybody pays for the tariff one way or another, and I suppose that higher tariffs are the only way that the U.S. can protect domestic industry for long enough that they could get back in the game. But, of course, that's not going to happen tomorrow or even in the next 2 or 3 or 4 years. It's going to take a while. So the problem is really getting from here to there. If we enforce these tariffs to give U.S. manufacturers a break, it's going to create a lot of difficulties in our economy, particularly for certain goods that we're not capable of making now, but which will not be available other than through foreign sources. So the tariff thing has become such a mishmash that it's like who knows. Even if you start out on classical economic footing with David Ricardo and the idea of the law of comparative advantage, it gets very complicated what that advantage is if every country on earth is in some sort of currency manipulation Olympiad. So if anybody writes an op-ed column that purports to have figured out tariffs, you can tune it out because they haven't.
The 50% tariffs on steel and aluminum from Canada, I've heard, are going to drive up canned good prices, something horrible.
Well, the good news is, you read that the steel tariff could push, or the combination of tariffs could push the cost of an automobile in the U.S. up by about $10,000. But the good news is, it can't. Who can afford to pay any more than the whatever it is, the average car costs $48,000 or something like that, and we're already so deep in hock from buying other stuff that there's no way the price of cars can go up a further $10,000. We've really kind of hit the ceiling. I mean, I don't buy new cars anymore. I'll just buy a used car, 2 years on it, and I'm not paying up 50 grand for, or, well, 60, 65 grand for some new SUV. And I think there are probably a lot of Americans in that same boat. So it's like things are already at a price where if they raise them anymore, who cares? I'm not buying.
What's the state of real estate?
It's headed into something that will make the 1930s depression look like a Sunday picnic. You know, we're going to be coming in deflating the housing base. We're going to be coming from a much more pumped up condition than we were in the 30s when they didn't have mortgages. And, you know, it's everybody's got a vacation home, a second home. And even though I think that the depreciation of all of our first homes will be about 70 to 80%, I think it's going to be a lot worse for vacation homes, especially in places where it requires a lot of fuel to keep them warm in the winter or air conditioned in the summer. So I think that we'll have a complete collapse in the second home market, and but the residential real estate is headed into something more on the order of, let's say, 75%. And keep in mind, we got halfway there in 2007 and 8. These are not ridiculous numbers. We got halfway there before we went into the most spectacular stimulus in the history of the world. That's what saved us from losing the remaining 65% of the value of homes. But this time there's going to be nothing to save us. They're not going to be able to bring rates down to stimulate the market. There's no way we're ever going to get another refi cycle in our lifetime. So without those props, the next housing collapse will finish the job. It'll finish what was left undone in 2007 and 8. And of course we have inflated to much higher levels than we were then, and having learned nothing from the experience.
Commercial real estate, is it pretty well dead?
It's pretty cool. I mean, it's a deception that's so blatant you could almost laugh at it, really. To take, a paradigm in New York City, the landlords are saying, don't worry, we'll let you keep making payments. Nobody's taking the write-downs in the cities. We know that the value of commercial real estate, of these office towers in every city in the country, has diminished. It's collapsed, really. But the numbers, the appraisals, are still sort of hanging up there in the, if not the ionosphere, then the stratosphere. And none of the cities want to mark the properties to market, and the landlords don't want to mark anything to market. So that's why nationwide we've avoided so far a price collapse. Everybody's just sort of playing the game and pretending that it hasn't happened already, but the conditions are there. The buildings, the vacancy rates are very high, and we pretty much know that the office workers are never coming back. And not just because it's a matter of habit that they don't like to come into work anymore, but the jobs are gone. When Musk took over Twitter, he proved that you can take a big company with a lot of employees who would come in around noon, just because that's when they turn the espresso makers on. They Musk proved that you can operate a company like that with maybe 15 or 20 employees. So there's no need even for if you look at an office tower, and you have to ask yourself, who would be in those towers? If you're standing outside the building at 8 a.m. and they empty out with people, who are those people? Are they wearing suits going to work? Of course they aren't. So there's nobody to fill those office towers. And you have, in New York City and other cities, you have economic death occurring at three levels. One, above ground, that's the office tower with all the vacancies. And at the ground level, all the amenities, everything from a hot dog push cart to tickets at Carnegie Hall, have been diminished in value because the workers aren't there. And of course, below ground, you have the real killer, and that's your transit system, which requires 70 or 80% fullness to not to operate, but to pay the healthcare, the pension benefits of the guy behind the glass, barrier. The guy selling those tokens has a package worth $110,000 with healthcare and retirement and everything. And that's the real cost of the transit system. So we're not going to escape that either until all the contracts that give us pension plans are reneged on.
Rick, what would be your overall view on what's happening economically and on the markets?
Well, I kind of like you gotta love some of the bloggers out there, particularly of two minds. There's a guy who's getting ready for the worst, and he grows his own tomatoes, and he's got a backyard that provides high nutrition food, and he's learning self-sufficiency, and I think that's probably the best way to go, the kind of Charles Hugh Smith plan. You got to get ready for the inevitable. So, and the inevitable, it's just a question of working the numbers. Things don't work out so well, and it's hard even to extrapolate out the baby boomers' good times for as much as 5 years. You know, I've had some extensive use of my Medicare benefits lately, and I'm telling you that the sums involved are rather large, and I just know that nobody can really afford these benefits if you sort of extend things beyond the golden calf, which is this illusion we have with the stock market trading relatively close to the all-time highs. So I think just the idea, core idea, is don't kid yourself. It's not going to end well, and you need to be prepared for the unhappy ending.
Rick, thank you so much for chatting with us. Where can our listeners subscribe to Rick's Picks?
I'm so glad you asked, Jim. They can go to rickackerman.com, and there is a free trial tab at the top of the page. And if you click, you don't have to leave credit card information. You can subscribe and get all of the amenities of Rick's Picks, including a chat room, trading room, that I think is one of the best in the world. We've got great traders from all over everywhere, and they're a very kindly bunch. They share tradable ideas in real time. And, of course, there's my commentary and the trading actionable, what I call touts, that are updated 24/7. So, again, rickackerman.com. Just go up to free trial up top, and you'll be in like Flint.
Rick, thank you again.
Well, thank you, Jim. I really do appreciate the opportunity to connect with your audience, and I'll look forward to our next time together.
My guest has been Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. Coming up, Mark Leibovit, next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Mark Leibovit, editor and publisher of the Leibovit VR newsletters, also known as VRTrader.com. He's speaking to us from Arizona. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Glad to be here, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Mark, can you tell us a little bit about VRTrader.com?
Okay, that's my website. That's the URL shortcut. Company is Leibovit VR Newsletters. It started decades ago as the volume reversal survey. That's what VR stood for. And we sort of moved it into the VR Trader when the internet got launched. But based on the concept that volume precedes price, and I have all these technical charts. If you're a subscriber at VRTrader.com and in the nightly newsletter, you'll see the individual stocks, many stocks that we, or indexes that we're, you know, studying. And you'll see the little VR symbols in there, and they're usually coincident with change of direction, up or down, in the market. So what I I studied with a technical analyst way back. Let's see now, I'm losing track of time. It was the early 1970s, and his name was Roger Cole. And I think I've told this story before. And he had been around way back into the early part of the 20th century, having claimed to have known a lot of the big names of Wall Street, the founders of some of the big firms. In fact, he told me a great story about him being on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange as a young man, or before they had the electronic tape, and you had to write prices on chalkboards and so forth. So he goes way back. And basically, you know, he sort of my coach and got me started and interested in technical analysis. A lot of interesting stuff about manipulation in the markets, about how market makers play with prices, how news is sort of manipulated. He actually told me a story, which, you know, when I tell this to people, they believe it more today than they did what I talked about it years ago. But he claimed to have delivered checks to various publications to pay to put stories in the paper to try to influence the movement of stock prices. So I don't want to mention the names of the newspapers and stuff, but some of the big names on that are published today, that he would, you know, walk in, say, here's X dollars, please, you know, here's the story, print this story. So he got me, you know, pretty cynical about the industry. And, you know, we're looking back in the 1970s now about what Wall Street is really all about. And when you think about it today, it really hasn't changed very much. It's influenced by big money, lobbyists in Washington influence congressional people. And we know there's been a lot of money paid, and a lot of us senators or congressmen making a lot of money on so-called privileged information. So, you know, basically he was telling me, you know, this is the nature of the business, and you're not going to get around it. But one thing you could do is look at the stock prices and see if there's any big change in volume patterns up or down, which might indicate that some of the smart money is acting in the market, and you may want to follow that pattern, particularly if it's sellers coming in or buyers coming in. And I noticed years later when I start trading, I only traded for a short period of time. I think it was less than 2 years on the, it was on the Midwest Stock Exchange and later the Chicago Board Options Exchange in Chicago. But, you know, when you're on the floor and you're watching prices move, but more than that, you you see, like, brokers come in representing some of the big firms looking to buy or sell call or put options. And usually the stock tends to move in the direction that they're buying or selling. In other words, they know something, or they know there's big orders following them and so forth. There was one case where I was there, and a brokerage firm came in and started buying a lot of call options in a certain stock, and there was really nothing happening in the stock at all. And we find out the next day that that firm that came in and bought those call options just released a research report on that company, so they knew it was coming, and they loaded up on some call options, and obviously the stock went up, and somebody made some money. So it's you know, it's volume precedes price. That's sort of what it's all about. You know, the money comes in, whether they know a story is coming or whether they're creating it themselves, and that's sort of the background of just the nature of the beast, so to speak. So I don't want to sound too cynical. I mean, that's just the nature of it. I mean, there's been trading going on for thousands of years, probably back in the deserts of ancient times, where they're trading copper and all kinds of commodities and incense and salt and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, smart money moves prices, and that's sort of the nature of it. So be our trader. You know, we're just looking at a bunch of charts, and we try to scan them and try to anticipate movements up and down. And, you know, for those who want to spend more time with me on an individual basis and learn, I'm sure at some point we can do some tutorial and do some consultation stuff on technical analysis, a whole classes and stuff. I've been asked to do this over the years, just haven't put it all together. But I did publish a booklet a few years ago, sort of outlining the theory behind the VR or the volume reversal. So it tends to be both a near-term and short-term indicator, because it's sort of giving you an indication of the movement, the short-term movement. But we also put this on weekly and monthly charts, and we'll see big shifts, and we'll see movement in that direction beyond the daily patterns. So the bottom line is that's sort of the main indicator that got me started in the business. I've added a lot of other stuff over the years, cycles and stuff we can talk about in the next few minutes, but it's amazing. You know, I'm looking at a chart pattern, and you see some selling come in, and sure enough, within hours and days following, that the stock or index turned south, and you saw the selling come in, and somebody knew something or anticipated something. If you're a long-term investor and you're just looking to be in the markets, you know, this is probably irrelevant to you because you're not trading the market. You probably have an advisor, or you have your retirement plan, and you just put money away. And over time, stocks tend to go higher, as we know, even though we have these big shakeouts along the way. But this is more for those who are like me, who are following the markets day to day or week to week, you know, trading the market, more active in the markets, not passive, leaving our money sitting at some money manager or in a bunch of ETFs or mutual funds, which is fine if that's your perspective and you have a business and you're not looking to trade the market. You're just looking to put money away, knowing long term it tends to go higher. But for those who are looking for more aggressive view of the markets, that's sort of what I do.
Well, let's get into technical analysis. When you're looking at the markets or stocks, you use technical analysis. Can you walk us through how you apply it?
So we have a chart, and a chart of I use what is known as a bar chart. There are various types of charts you can put up on your screen if you're a technical trader. Many use candlestick charts. Go back to the old Japanese system, created several hundred years ago. I just use normal bar charts, which is just a line that represents the high and low of the day in a particular index or stock or commodity. And it's plotted across the screen. It can be done on a 1 minute basis, 5 minute basis, 30 minute, daily, weekly, whatever you choose. And I go beyond that and I color code them because that's important for me to identify what's happening. So if something is going up, it causes the line that I'm describing to you to be blue, and if it's going down, it's red. So if you're looking at my screen, you'll see these vertical lines, blue and red, up and down. And then on the bottom of the screen, I've got a whole series of lines that signify volume. So if it's a blue line going up and the line below it is red on the volume line, that means it's rallying on less volume. And if it's blue on the bottom volume line, then it means it's tied into the blue on the upper line, and that means it's going up on positive volume. So conversely, if we have a down tick or a negative bar in red on the top line, that means it's coming down, it's negative. And on the bottom, if it's blue, it means it's coming down on less volume. And red, it's coming down on more volume. So the red indicates down for price and increasing volume on one line. And on the upside, blue for up, or blue or red on the volume line below. So you have to see my screens. I encourage you to go to VR Trader, and, you know, we can be happy to send you a picture of what we're looking at here. So we have basically, and then on top of that, we go a little bit further. You know, technical analysis is very intense. I can't even count how many dozens and dozens of technical indicators that have been created over the years that you can put over the screen and study these vertical lines that I just mentioned to you. There are what is known as moving averages, which is an average of the price of a particular stock or index over a specified period of time, whether it's 5 days, 10 days, 30 days, 6 months, whatever. So you can put a moving average up on the screen of the price, and that's a little zigzag on the screen. And then there's indicators like stochastics, which show relative momentum, and those other little indicators that you can put on the bottom of the screen. And there's you know, various other tools like that. I mean, I can literally open it. We have actually a book that I published. It's called The Trader's Book of Volume. And I guess I should really encourage you to look at that. You can get a copy on Amazon. And it's about 480 pages. And it shows pretty much everything that I'm trying to explain to you here verbally.
Mark, you have rules for the theory of stock picking. What are those rules?
Well, you're going to laugh, but you want to sell high and buy low. Buy low, sell high, which we've all heard and talked about for decades. So you like to buy stocks that have experienced a correction and are starting to turn up. And the same goes for the overall market as an index. And we just saw this with the big sell-off in the market in April, where we had a big washout. And then we reversed sharply off the early April lows in what is known in technical analysis as a V formation. And the letter V is in victory. And if you look at charts over the decades, you'll see that a V formation off of a bottom is generally a good sign that that's the bottom and we're going to go higher. So one of the main theories that you want to follow is, you know, buy not necessarily on weakness, but when you see the reversal. And there's so many stocks that we can talk about. Another one just recently, of course, is Tesla, which had just a big sell-off in the last, you know, few days or so as Donald Trump and Elon Musk got into a little spat about the politics and about the budget. And you had a big washout in Tesla. And then it reversed as it just did a couple of days ago, creating that little reversal pattern that I just referred to. So that got you motivated, or should have gotten you motivated to buy. So again, you want to look for that on the buy side, and on the upper end, if you see a reversal off of the top, particularly with increasing volume, as we call the volume reversal, negative VR, and you have to look at my book, and I have to show you some charts that gives you a good sense that you should be exiting that stock or shorting that stock or index. And then, you know, that's sort of the basic rule for me. You know, I'm looking for bottoming formations and topping formations, but I want to see volume confirm the bottom and top. And then you have to decide, are you trading or are you going to hold for a more intermediate play? Depends what the perspective is on the market. We have ours, of course, and you go from there.
Could Warren Buffett be using the same rules for stock picking?
Well, we have a good example of that. That might have been the case. Just recently, in the last actually couple, 3 months, there's one particular stock that we got into. It's a company called Constellation Brands, ticker symbol STZ. They're the ones that manufacture at the beers, as you know, Modelo beer and so forth. Very famous. They also have wines and whatever. And the stock has been suffering for a bit. Apparently the public is not as enthusiastic for the wines and the beer as they used to be, which is sort of surprising. You would think, particularly now with the summer coming up and with sports and so forth, maybe it will turn, but stock was in the mid-200s, had a big sell-off, now into the mid-100s, and that is the kind of pattern I just was referring to. If you want to see a big sell-off and you want to see some confirmation of the bottom, so we were looking for that, and having dropped that much, it did reverse. We jumped in, and then within about a week or two, there was a report that Warren Buffett had taken a sizable investment position in Constellation Brands, $1.5 billion, and I think since then he's added even more to it. So we may be approaching the same animal two different ways. You know, he sees value. He's a value investor. He saw the stock down and oversold relative to their potential for selling, I guess, beer and wine in the future. And he has his own metrics. And I had my technical reasons, the fact that it sold off so much and reversed off the bottom. So whether he's using charts and or his value investing, you just never know. You'd have to talk to him. I guess he's more on the value investment side than on the chart side. But, you know, you show me any analyst and I'll show you a closet technician. Everybody looks at charts, you know, whether they use them as their main indicator to buy and sell or complementary, that's to be discussed. But, you know, I'm sure it had some influence. So I felt very good about that call, particularly since Warren got involved.
How important are charts in technical analysis?
It's everything, Jim. That's the Bible of investing and trading. How can you determine whether a stock is a buy or sell without looking at a picture of how it's traded? See what it looks like. So if I just mentioned the name to you and you go out and just buy it, sure, that could happen, or sell it if somebody said sell. But 99% of the time, anyone who's educated in the business or looking at the markets pulls up a chart and gets an idea of where this index or stock has traded over the days, weeks, months, or years. You get a perspective of where you are, and that's everything. So, you know, we need we need some ground rules here, and a chart is your picture. It's the footprints in the sand, so to speak, of what a stock is doing or an index is doing or a commodity is doing. So it's very important.
Do you use trading parameters?
We try to. You know, you want to get an idea of what your goals are. And, you set targets. And this is part and parcel to the kind of analysis I do and other technical analysts do. Are you looking for a 5% move, 10%, 20%? What is your goal to the upside? And by the same token, what kind of mental stop do you have if you're wrong, assuming you are trading? You know, you don't want to just let something drop and drop and drop. You must have some idea where you're wrong. So these are the trading parameters the rules that you set in buying or selling. So we have our set of rules. There's X amount of points we tend to look for on the upside or downside, depending whether we're long or short, and we reevaluate those levels. So a lot of this is some of the proprietary nature of our work, what those numbers are. But over the rules, over the years, those rules have worked out pretty well for us in terms of volatility. So, you know, we have just general guidelines regarding how much we want to suffer if we're wrong or rejoice when it's going up.
Cycle theory, are there different cycles and do they leave a footprint?
There are so many cycles out there. There's economic cycle. We can talk about, I'm not an economist, and I'm glad I'm not, because most economists have been incorrect about forecasting the economy and especially the market. Many of them work for the Federal Reserve. But, you know, my thinking is there are seasonal cycles, which we talked about on air before. For example, you have the autumnal equinox. You got the summer solstice coming up now here in the third week of June, and you have the winter solstice and so forth. And these are big picture cycles. Over the years, you find that markets more than not tend to change direction around seasonal cycles. You also have very short-term cycles. There's a cycle we laugh at it when we use it every time, but it's called Turnaround Tuesday. Markets tend to turn around on Tuesdays. You can ask me why. I can't answer that question, but we sort of say, on every Tuesday, it's Tuesday, and we'll see the market may have a turnaround. There's also a cycle which was identified by a friend of mine, Don Wallenchuk, years ago, called Weird Wally Wednesday. And this is the Wednesday prior to an options expiration, which is the week Friday following, not the current Friday. And there's often a pattern where you'll see an unraveling of positions among traders or reestablishing of positions around traders a week and a half ahead of an options expiration. And sometimes that causes volatility on that Wednesday. So we call it a Weird Wally Wednesday because it has a some volatility associated with it. Usually it's down, and then the following week on an options expiration, the market tends to recover and rally. So that's sort of a crazy cycle out there. And, you know, we have, you know, other cycles, you know, and other events like the Santa Claus rally, for example, that everybody's been talking about, or the turkey shoot around Thanksgiving, for example. So, you know, then they talk about a summer rally, for example. Is that something that you can determine is a cycle in the market? You have cycles that are based on the decennial pattern. Some people study this, and we, you know, refer to it occasionally, like if the year ends in 2, 3, 4, 5, so forth, up to 10, how does that relate to previous years when that happened? So how does 2002 compare to 2012 or 2012 to 2022 on a 10-year cycle? So there's a lot of people that use those types of cycles too, and those are sort of bigger picture. Now, we could just spend hours going through all the possible market cycles that are out there. Many are economic cycles too. Obviously, we have recessions and recoveries in the market, and we have the very famous presidential four-year cycle out there. Every 4 years, the cycle comes in and tends to be coincident with either market, usually a trough in the market versus a high, but you do have the presidential cycle as well. And you have cycles that they call, you know, pre-election or election cycles based on the election of a, here we're, of course, talking about the U.S. and, you know, presidential events. You can go on and on and on. So what you have to do is play, you know, look at these more on an intermediate to bigger picture basis, not for a short-term basis. If you are a longer-term player, of course, they're going to be more value to you. But there are cycles that point to how the markets will act the year prior to a presidential election, the year following, and so forth and so on. There are various companies out there that produce these charts. We put them on our newsletter, and we show some of these cycles in there, too, and they're interesting. And, you know, whether you're going to invest on them, we use them as a reference point or something you have to decide depending on what your goals and timing is. But they are definitely there because they work. And there is, you know, value in studying them and knowing where you are in a cycle. So that's sort of a really off-the-cuff response to your question. Very important if you look at market cycles, identify the ones that are out there. There are books you can buy on market cycle. We talk about them in our newsletter. And it's common knowledge that the economy has run through cycles, boom and busts, and we see that in stocks as well. So just common sense to study them and be aware of them.
This week we had a strawberry full moon, the final full moon of spring, named after the time when wild strawberries start to ripen. June 20th and 21st, the summer solstice. Could the summer solstice bring volatility to some markets?
Yeah, that's my concern here, short term. I've been, on some of our previous interviews, I've been sort of warning about we got to watch out around the summer solstice coming up. And this goes back to my comment a few moments ago about watching seasonal patterns in the market, where you tend, not all the time, but more often than not, sort of a change of direction in the market. You know, a classic example I like to use is the vernal equinox, which I think March 20th, back in 2020, that was the bottom of the COVID panic when the market crashed back then, and literally almost to the day. So we have a June 2021 date coming up. It doesn't have to be exactly to the date, but it said, you know, watch out. You know, the market had a big sell-off into April, big recovery here into May, into early June, and we have this cycle coming up here, and maybe we're going to see a little indigestion, maybe a little pullback here before we resume higher, which I think we will ultimately. So just a little bit of a caution flag. And like you just referred to the strawberry full moon. Well, the lunar cycles are important. We've been talking about that forever. I've been tracking them since 1972, and I plot them out on a chart. And if you do, and for all markets, gold markets, stock markets, soybean markets, you know, corn market, treasury bonds, so forth. And you'll see often around lunar cycles, markets tend to change direction, and whether it's a full moon or a new moon and so forth. Some very notable analysts have identified this over the decades and for centuries, and there is an impact when you think about that the human being is comprised of mostly water. The moon has a gravitational effect on the tides and on the planet and on human beings, and it sort of makes sense that there might be an effect. We all know that, you know, during full moons, emergency rooms tend to be packed, or more so than at other times. So that's the old term where lunacy, I guess, started to be derived. In any event, whether it's new moon, or quarter moons, it's important. If you are trading, commodity traders love this stuff, and to see if there's a correlation. So as a general rule, if you're rallying into a lunar cycle or selling off into a lunar cycle, that's an indication it might reverse direction. So that's just a general guideline. We watch them. And as we're making this recording, you know, we're sort of running into a lunar period. And as you just referred to, the summer solstice period. So a little caution should be raised during this time frame.
Do seasonal patterns or seasonalities tend to follow geocosmics?
That's a study that I would have to make. I would assume, yes. We have, you know, the geocosmics, of course, to refer to the seasonal patterns that I refer to, and the seasonal patterns in and of themselves are geocosmic cycles. Now, of course, we've got solar events out there, planetary events here on the Earth. So we can talk about those in a moment. But the seasonal patterns are geocosmic, so it's one and the same.
Do solar flares tend to affect markets?
This is a study that I have to make. I raised this question in one of our previous interviews in my newsletter. We had a high activity of solar flares, and we had a market sell-off. So as with the lunar studies, we're going to have to go back and do some homework on this, because there are different levels of solar activity in terms of intensity. So we have to plot all this out and correlate. My gut feeling is probably yes, because if it influences the planet and causes auroras and all kinds of imbalances in the atmosphere, you know, we're looking at an effect much more, potentially more significant than the lunar cycles. And if they affect the planet, they affect the atmosphere, they affect, you know, the whole cosmic, I guess, well-being of the planet. There have been some dramatic events of solar flares. The most famous has been documented at Carrington event in the 1860s, which fried the Western Union lines, which was the only technology we had at the time. But there have been some significant flares in recent, you know, months, and seem to be in a period of increasing solar activity. And we also know that some satellites have been affected, including some of the Elon Musk Starlink satellites that got damaged. So if that's the case, and it has that kind of power, you know, it affects the planet. It affects our health. It affects the weather. It affects our emotions. It can affect the markets. So there's a correlation there, and we have to sort of prove that out in terms of day-to-day. But we can't be immune to these type of forces. And, we all know the power of weather and the power of, you know, the power of the planet when it turns against us, whether it's tornadoes or tsunamis or earthquakes or volcanic activity, what that can do to humankind. And we just have to be respectful of that and understand there could be a strong correlation. So my gut feeling is there is. I have to prove it out statistically, but I think increased solar activity definitely affects us and the market.
Do sunspots tend to affect markets?
Well, you know, the sunspots are part and parcel to the solar flares and the solar emissions. It appears, and I'm not a solar expert, but apparently when the sunspots are facing the Earth, that's when we're in the greatest danger. and all the reading when there's a large sunspot is there and facing the Earth, that is what could cause these emissions. And, you know, I guess the cosmic forces that we were referring to as flares affecting us here on the planet. So the sunspots are something we have to track. I know with watching some of the recent studies at astronomical meeting, and they were saying, well, the sunspots are facing toward the planet Mars this week, so Mars is going to be vulnerable to some solar activity versus the Earth. So the sunspots are very, very crucial. And from what I understand, the Carrington event that I just had referred to was a result of a huge solar spot that faced the planet and had some, you know, huge impact. And I guess the size of the spot must have been abnormal to a certain degree on the large size that would have created that Carrington event. The sunspots are critical.
Does volcanic activity affect markets?
Well, it sure could, Jim. You know, we get, we don't want to see it, but, you know, on my newsletter, I actually published this study that's put out every month or so from the Smithsonian Institution. I think last report is that 47 active volcanoes on the planet right now. That means they're erupting all the time, and we don't hear about them or watch them, and their intensity may not be as great as we imagine, you know, a super explosion, Mount St. Helens or that type of event, but we have a lot of volcanic activity. And the big fear, you know, we can sit and worry about something that will never happen, but the big fear is that we get a super volcanic type event. And I guess the classic example, potential example, is the super volcano under Yellowstone National Park here in the U.S., which they say if that ever blows, it's probably the end of North America in terms of civilized activity, in terms of the negative power of that explosion, the cloud cover, the damage that would result, the fact that the atmosphere would be so polluted that, you know, it would dull the sunlight and it could affect the growth of crops and all kinds of nasty things. So there have been some super volcanic explosions in the millennia, and doesn't mean there's going to be one now. But there have been, in the mid-19th century, a couple examples of huge volcanoes going off and out in the Pacific, and the effects were seen all the way into Europe, and that could happen at any time. It seems like the area that seems to be most vulnerable is Iceland, which has been, according to some studies, the source of one of the huge explosions in the distant past. And in recent years, we've seen volcanic activity there, blocking airplane flights, you know, not too many years ago in the last decade or so, and there seems to be a lot of activity. So it'd be no great surprise to me if some super volcanic event came out of the Iceland area versus the Yellowstone area. But, yeah, we can't sit here worrying about it, but it's there, and you got to track it. And one day, unfortunately, there's going to be some big one, and it could unfortunately affect us. On a lesser scale, of course, you can get tsunamis and all kinds of other activity from the earthquakes that result from these activities. But the answer to your question, can volcanic activity affect markets? And the answer is certainly yes.
Does technical analysis work on large caps, mid caps, juniors, micro caps, indexes, and commodities?
All the above. If you can chart it, technical analysis works. You can put any pattern on the screen, and this is what I have argued to people who are just becoming familiar now to the crypto market, you know, Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. Just like any financial pattern or any financial activity, you can chart price, high, low, close, where it tracks. You can create a chart, and, you know, it could be any commodity. You know, it could be any subject that you want to track that has a range of activity, you know, and plot it on the screen. And once you do that, patterns that have unfolded over the decades seem to manifest themselves. One of the classic patterns, and I might as well just give you an example of one, which you see all over the place, it's known as a head and shoulders pattern. And what's a head and shoulders? Where you see a little, we can imagine for a second, a head, and then a left shoulder and a right shoulder on the screen. So the head would be like a little bump at the top, and there'd be two little bumps on the right and left of the big bump. And that's known as a head and shoulders. And there's also an inverse head and shoulders, where the head is at the bottom of your chart and the shoulders rise above it to the left and right. But over the years, you see this on every chart of every kind, of every nature, and it tends to forecast big movements up or down, depending whether it's a normal head and shoulders and the neckline of that shoulders is broken, or whether it's an inverse pattern and the neckline on the inverse to the upside is broken, which means it goes up. And it's just one of the classic patterns. If you pull out any textbook, the classic textbooks out there, I would recommend the book that was written decades ago called the McGee and Edwards Technical Analysis Book, and it plots, shows all kinds of patterns, dozens and dozens, but probably the classic one. They probably start off with this, if I'm not too mistaken, of the head and shoulders that I referred to. And why something like that works or doesn't work, I can't explain, but it just does. So if you just imagine a chart with that pattern on it and dozens of other patterns, which you can see in, for example, in this McGee and Edwards book I'm referring to, these are price-related patterns, not volume patterns, which I use, but you can tie them together. That gives you, proof of why it's worth studying technical analysis, because the patterns are repetitive in all time frames, in all markets. I mean, you can see them on 5-minute charts, on yearly charts, monthly charts. It's just incredible. So that's why it's a real science. And for so many years, unfortunately, Wall Street wouldn't acknowledge technical analysis. An organization was ultimately created, the Market Technicians Association, which I was a member of years ago. And nobody would want to talk about it. You know, everything, it was only fundamentally related. What was the earnings of the company? What was the economic forecast for the economy and so forth and so on? But most traders and professionals were closet technicians. They would look at these charts because they know they have predictive value. So finally it came into recognition, and now they have technical analysis programs on television, and charts are shown, and patterns are discussed. But for so many years, it was poo-pooed as some type of pseudoscience. Well, as I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, we had Japanese candlestick charts, which were created several hundred years ago, which were apparently used by the Japanese in their study of markets. So, this is something which is the reality of the business and the reality of doing any study. You know, you want to look at the chart, you want to study the patterns, and see where we go. But it applies to all markets, and we're excited the fact that we have these as tools that allow us to open the magic door to the investment world, because otherwise you're investing and trading blindly.
What's your outlook for cryptocurrencies, especially Bitcoin?
I am a bull and have been a bull, and the sky's the limit on Bitcoin and on cryptos, in my opinion. The world has changed, and you have huge investors and backers for this, for example, Bitcoin, since you mentioned that one. Larry Fink over at BlackRock, and he's the head of BlackRock, which is the largest money management firm in the world, several trillion under management. I think it was the spring of 2024, launched the Bitcoin ETF, which is an exchange-traded fund. So it's a fund you can actually buy Bitcoin through a fund, so you don't have to actually buy Bitcoin itself. But the recognition on the part of BlackRock and the organization to create such an event was, you know, acknowledgement of the legitimacy and future for Bitcoin. And as you know, Bitcoin had a huge move in the past year, partially a result to the creation of that fund and other funds. And this is just the tip of the iceberg, because there are thousands, and probably more importantly, a few hundred key other cryptos that are out there. So, and you've got all kinds. It's such a complicated subject to cover it on the short interview, but I would encourage our listeners to go to my VR blockchain letter, and where we summarize some of the activity in many of the cryptos, including Bitcoin itself, which is not the only one, as I mentioned, and get an idea of what's going on. But the world is moving to, to a digital world. And, you know, you can be in the middle of nowhere, and if you have a computer and you have internet access, you could buy and sell using cryptos, and particularly Bitcoin, and you don't need a bank account. You know, you don't need a checkbook. You don't need cash. You can do it all electronically now, and the world has changed. I think that's a reflection of what the crypto world has evolved to. And now we have here in the U.S., Donald Trump is a big supporter of the Bitcoin market, and there's legislation. I think it just passed one called the Genius Act in Congress, and what it's trying to do is set out the ground rules for the coins. And the plan is also to create a Bitcoin reserve here in the U.S. and also a crypto reserve fund as well. So, the future is bright, and it's like anything else. Nothing goes up every day, but we have crypto moving and a lot of interest in it. Bitcoin itself, I think at the time we're making this recording, is around 109,000. You know, can we see 145,000 in the next 2-3 months? Yes. Could we see 200,000 or more beyond that? The answer is yes, too. Remember, if you don't know this, but there's only a limited amount of Bitcoin out there. It's a finite source, and on top of that, there's part of the Bitcoin mechanism that cuts in half the amount of Bitcoins every several years, reducing the amount of float, which inevitably will drive prices higher. So some people speculate, well, Bitcoin could be $1 million a coin at some point in the future. Anything is possible. So you have less supply, more demand. The result could be such an event. So I think smart people are in there. You have ETFs out there. And there are ETFs now created for Ethereum, which is another crypto. And another one, which is one of our favorites, XRP, has created some ETFs where you can purchase the coins through the exchange-traded fund rather than actually buy the crypto itself, which gives it a lot of liquidity and the wind is at the back, so to speak. In fact, the classic example was and is the creation of the gold ETF, GLD, by the World Gold Council several decades ago, and that was a wind at the back to the gold market, because when somebody purchased shares in the ETF, the money managers at one ETF had to go out and buy the physical gold to fulfill the demand, and the same thing is now happening in the crypto market. So the self-fulfilling prophecy, everything goes up and down, there's cycles, there's news and so forth, but trends up.
Mark, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money. Where can our listeners follow you and subscribe to your newsletter?
And yes, go to VR Trader. That's Victor Robert, VRTrader.com. And you go to that webpage, you'll see a whole screen of various newsletters, including the blockchain letter, which covers the crypto that I just referred to, and the metal resource letter, which covers gold and silver and so forth, and on and on and on. Several letters up on the screen. I would recommend taking a look at our platinum letter, because we tend to follow all the major markets in the platinum letter, but we also follow specifics in more detail in some of the other newsletters up on your screen. So that's at vrtrader.com.
Thanks again, Mark.
Have a great week. Thanks, Jim.
My guest has been Mark Leibovit, editor and publisher of the Leibovit VR newsletters, also known as VRTrader.com. He was speaking to us from Arizona. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Rick Ackerman and Mark Leibovit. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.